Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As we usually tell you, we are engaged with you once a week to talk about the things that matter. And tonight, though, we are recorded for reasons I'll tell you in just a moment. Now, you hear a lot of these types of messages during the holidays and often after tragedies. We hear messages about the things that really matter. Usually that means an emphasis on the people, careers, and lifestyle that bring happiness or at least personal satisfaction. Often those ideas fade with the January bills and the economic necessities of a coming year kick in, and national measurements of prosperity and the push of financial growth and well-being can often dwarf an individual. Beyond Bhutan, are there societies drawing a better defining line for success other than money? Tonight, our panel considers that question. And a quick programming note I alluded to a little earlier. Our phones are in use tonight for the Radio Flyers campaign, so feel free to call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 to make a pledge during the show. In studio with me tonight are Kirsten Olson, Assistant Professor of Ecological Economics with UH Manoa's Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Management, and Regina Ostergaard-Klemm, Associate Professor of Environmental Science in the College of Natural and Computational Sciences at Hawaii Pacific University. And joining us by phone, Sean McGuire, the Sustainability Coordinator for Benton County, Oregon, who we last talked with when he was speaking at the Hawaii Economic Association in October. Welcome to all of you, and thank you for making time to come back and have this discussion with us again.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you.
Sean, I want to start with you, since it has been a little while since you were here in Honolulu, and we had a chance to begin to explore some of this. For a lot of people, it's so difficult to separate their, you know, personal self-worth, their identity, all of that from what they make. And yet that's very much what, in a lot of ways, you're suggesting that people really need to do to be able to find a greater sense of purpose and satisfaction.
That's true. And also, thank you so much for having us back. This is great. As we were talking when I was back there, you know, this American dream created kind of romantically a few decades ago where one person could take care of the household, and you could have your house and your 2.1 dogs and all of that and presents under the tree and everything. Again, that was romanticized, and that was also with half the population. Clearly, today we just don't have that. We have found ourselves limited socially and economically and environmentally with doubling of population and infrastructure and all these things, and yet we still have this idealized notion of, oh, well, we have to have this much wealth and this salary and more presence, and somehow more equals better. And so because of those dynamics, and we just cannot continue to grow and build our way out of this, we are having to redefine and reexamine ourselves on what makes life worthwhile. What are those components that truly make a good individual and make ourselves feel better, as well as having stronger connections with our community? So I think we're as we start reaching these limits, we're having to redefine these, and I think that that's a lot of what's going on right now.
In some ways, is this a return to ways that people knew before industrialization?
I think so. I believe so. I was, you know, at the conference in Hawaii, and I mean this, it was, I had some wonderful conversations. I think Hawaii is a very good case in point where you still have this need for more and this traditional sense of the economy, and yet you're strapped by the fact that most everything you have is imported. So how do you reconcile the need for more with the limits on how to get those things and what matters most? So I was so encouraged about the sense of community and revitalizing and those connections. I just kept hearing the word engagement and connections over and over again, and that was, I think that's what we're shifting towards, or back to, I guess.
All right. I want to bring Kirsten and Regina into this conversation, too. You're part of the greater community here, having heard what Sean has been talking about and all just experiencing what has been happening in Hawaii with the push for more and watching what's happening with HTA and these stellar years that we've had and the idea that somehow we can grow ourselves out of the recession and all the rest of it that we were talking about for, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years after the recession. which has led us up to now, how do you begin to look at creating a deeper sense of community connection based on wealth other than money when it costs us so much money to live in Hawaii?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Regina, go ahead.
Okay, I think there's an ongoing discussion that we see around about the price of living in paradise. But I think also that people who live in Hawaii have a good sense of why we're living in Hawaii and the fact that Hawaii offers different opportunities for us to increase our life satisfaction beyond just monetarily. You know, maybe not as much need for more stuff, maybe not as much need for consuming other things that, as I characterize it to my students, I talk about the hedonic treadmill, which is this idea that we're on this treadmill and we keep going and going and going, and consumption is what keeps us going. And the more that we have, the more that we feel that we need. And it's this idea of relative wealth compared to our neighbors. So if you're stuck on this hedonic treadmill, you know, the only possibility of continuing is through consumption, is through having more things. But how do we get off? And I think that the case of Hawaii offers a little bit of a different opportunity for us to get off that hedonic treadmill, that maybe we don't even need to be on it because we have other things, the beauty of the nature that surrounds us. We have strong communities. The fact that we're living in an island environment, as I mentioned, there's a reason why we're living here. And I think it offers many other opportunities than other places where we can find life satisfaction elsewhere.
Kirsten Nelson, weigh in on that one.
Yeah, when I was deciding to move to Hawaii for my job at UH, I sat down, went on a hike with a good friend who'd lived here for 30 years, and I remember something that he said to me. His name's John Dixon. He lives over in Kailua. He said, well, Kirsten, some things in Hawaii are extremely expensive. Life is extremely expensive here, but a lot of things are free, and you have to build your life around the things that are free. And all of us really value all of those things that are essentially free, that we don't have to pay for our beaches and our beautiful scenery. But we really need to think as well about what we need to do in order to preserve those things that are quote-unquote free, that we build the quality of life that we have on.
When we talk about the things that are free and we talk about so much of Hawaii that you can enjoy without a cost to it, we're also watching a great deal of buildup of the part of life that would put a lot of people back on that hedonic treadmill. And so, you know, both of you, and then get Sean in on this too, looking at these gigantic condos that are going up at Ala Moana, brand new stores that are bringing a lot of, you know, high-end merchandise to Hawaii, the sense of great competition for having the best of the best stuff. And not that, you know, that's not fun now and again. That's now going to be an even more constant pressure that people may feel. How do you make that some sort of reconciliation to what you've just said a moment ago?
Mm-hmm. I think there's many key indicators that we can look at. And much of the work that Kirsten and I do, and that Sean definitely does, is looking at how you can find alternative indicators to measure things that are important so that it's an adjustment, so that it can adjust either positively or negatively against those things that you just mentioned about, the obvious things that are supposed to bring us life satisfaction by consuming and by having a larger house or a new kitchen or things like that. But, you know, to stop and think about capturing the stuff that really is good in our life, like, volunteerism, the sense of altruism, a sense of family, a sense of less congestion, perhaps, even if we sit in traffic on H1. That's something that's a negative impact on our life satisfaction. So how do you capture things that are like that? And there are definitely several indicators that are out there that can try and capture the things that are important to us that are not necessarily monetarily related or consumption-based or things like that.
What would those indicators be?
The one in particular that Kirsten and I have worked on in Hawaii is called the Genuine Progress Indicator, or GPI. Sean actually worked on that, and he can definitely talk about that. He's the Maryland was the first state to incorporate GPI into their and into how they look at their economy. And he's the expert, and he's been a good mentor to us to try and apply that to Hawaii. Of course, changing the circumstances for Hawaii versus Maryland, but it's an indicator that's exactly that. It's to try and capture those things that, are contributing to our progress or taking away from our progress other than just monetarily.
Well, we began to talk a little bit about that when he was here in October. Sean, can you flesh that out a little bit more for people who may not remember that short interview that we did while you were here?
Sure. I'd like to kind of key in on a couple of the words we've been saying. That was a wonderful description about walking on the beach, and that's free. Actually, that's not free. You may not have to take money out of your pocket to do those things, but nature provides so many services that we on a daily basis just take for free. And as Regina Kirsten alluded to, like what we tried to do back in Maryland was to start capturing those. It became a budgetary issue. So one good example would be wetlands, which is also part of the GPI. And I loved how you set that up, Beth Ann, about, oh, we have all these wonderful resources, let's do some more economic development, we have these jobs, and everything's better. But you just took out a whole bunch of wetlands, so every time it rains, now you have flooding. So where is that money coming from? And that gets back to that cycle that Regina and Kirsten are talking about. Like, we can build ourselves, but all those services that nature provides, so-called for free, are not for free. So one of the catalysts for when we did the GPI in Maryland was actually purely budgetary. We calculated that just the replacement cost of a wetland to do the stormwater services that a wetland provides is $25,000 to $30,000 an acre. So do we, any government, whether it's Oregon, Washington, Hawaii, Alaska, whatever, do you have enough money to offset all of those natural services that nature does for free? Well, clearly we're hitting those limits, as I mentioned earlier. So the answer is no. In addition, as also mentioned, there's the social services that we think are free, like volunteerism and housework. It's a huge one. Ask any single parent. The last thing you want to do is say that that's free or that that doesn't cost anything. Of course it does. And those are the things we have to value most. So the GPI starts to capture all of these, and not in some ethereal 50,000-feet academic example, but real-life budgetary constrictions and conflicts that each government has. And as a side note, it's been really wonderful. Yes, we started in Maryland, but Vermont has taken it and tweaked it just a little bit. In Hawaii, Kirsten and Regina kind of changed a little, as was mentioned. Each government is trying to reconcile these often conflicting goals and objectives of growth versus what's important and natural limits and social opportunity. So this is just one example of a tool that really helps us try to identify what we can do better.
So, Kirsten, where do we fall on the GPI?
Where do we fall? Well, the data are scarce, which is unfortunate, but in the calculations that we did for the state, the idea is that you take the same starting point as classic economic growth, the gross domestic product, and you use that and then adjust it for changes that economic growth brings about. So as Sean mentioned, the ecosystem services. So if we convert wetlands to subdivisions, if we cut down forests for ranching, or if we, any of these changes come with costs. And so one of the components of the Genuine Progress Indicator is to account for those changes, both positive and negative. We could have reforestation efforts, for instance, to native forests, and that would be a positive benefit. And you adjust to the GDP for that. Social changes, similarly, economic changes. And so this is a way that we can get better information in order to make more informed trade-off decisions in our policies. And that's really what we've been trying to do is through this indicator. As Sean says, it's just one of many tools that we can use to go about this, and maybe we'll have a chance to talk about some of the others. But it's a way to give a really handy indicator to policymakers and use it in policy setting. Like, what are these free things that we're losing? Because Sean's right. The ecosystem services aren't free when you need to replace them.
You're talking about, it seems, doing a bit of a cost-benefit analysis before policymakers decide to take an area of land for something other than what it's doing right now, if it's providing some sort of natural service as a wetland or a forest, and converting it into something else. When you talk to policymakers about this, Does this seem to resonate with them at all when the push has been for greater growth and the bottom line of how well people are doing and how well the state is doing based on wealth?
So I was really encouraged when we gave the presentation at the Hawaii Economic Association in October. We got very positive feedback from business leaders, developers, et cetera. I think Hawaii in particular, we're aware of why we live here. As Regina said, we like the beautiful vistas and the clean water and the coastal reefs. And so having something that showcases how economic growth has a flip side to it, and business leaders understand that there are two sides of a ledger, and to only look at one side of the ledger can be misleading.
Regina, when you were talking in October, and as Kirsten is saying, you're getting feedback from businesses, feedbacks and you know, sort of the atta girl, isn't that great kind of thing, is nice, but have you seen this translate into any meaningful changes to policy or even in the thinking about policy?
Yeah, I think I have. I mean, just the fact that the title of the HEA conference was Beyond GDP was, I think, a step in the right direction, a big hurdle to get over. We've also been in discussions with Hawaii Green Growth, the Hawaii Green Growth Initiative, about alternative indicators and the fact that we need to recognize all of these other things that are out there that are really, really hard to quantify. And I think that the conversation is definitely out there. Kirsten and I have worked with the OEQC, the Office of Environmental Quality Control, which is under the Department of Health, and in particular the Environment Council. Every year they're responsible for providing a report that gives a sort of like a report card of the environment in Hawaii. And we've used GPI to showcase GPI for 3 years now. And we were asked to provide that as a means of bringing up all these alternative types of costs and benefits that aren't recognized through regular economic growth. Invasive species, for example, is a perfect example of, you know, the impact that it could have on our economy. And if we're not out, you know, trying to figure out what those costs might be, then we're probably not making the best decisions.
Sean, can you put some context to what you see in Hawaii vis-a-vis what was happening in Maryland and some of the other costs that Regina was just talking about?
Yes, and I couldn't agree more. First, we need to kind of parse out government, I think, every time, especially now, and when it's used as a political whatever thing to be thrown at. There's two parts of government. There's the elected officials, and then there's the bureaucratic, and especially budgetary. I think it's harder for elected officials to go out there and, I mean, look at us. We've already been talking for 20 minutes. A soundbite is at most 20 seconds. So how do you convey all this information in a quick little soundbite as we're hearing on the presidential election going on? Versus budget officials. And that, the fiscal impact folks and the budgetary, they understand, you know, you can talk about all this who you want, but if I don't have enough money in my infrastructure or in my public works department to offset all of this growth, whether that's impervious surface, roads, maintenance, all these things, are we really truly going to get a profit? Are we going to get increased expenditures or revenue, or are we going to have to pay more? And I think that these kinds of tools, and exactly what Regina and Kirsten are talking about, resonates extremely strongly in our offices. I had the opportunity to be in the budget office here in Oregon for a few months, and that's why they brought me in to start looking at how these policies, yes, they have a positive, but they also have a negative, and where is that sweet spot? Are we actually costing more to grow and to build than we're retaining? We use the GPI back in Maryland for that exact policies. One was increasing mass transit ridership. Sure, it's going to cost a little bit more money in buses and metro and these kinds of things, but we're taking cars off the road and we're reducing pollution and reducing crashes. All of these indicators are part of the GPI. So, yes, it does definitely resonate, especially with the budget and the fiscal folks. And I love how we were just talking about this, just having these conversations, whether it's a conference of, you know, pretty traditional economists, whether it's even just talking about this right now. I remember back in 2000, no one knew what LEED was. No one knew what a green building was, and now it's just part of the lexicon. Same thing. We're having this conversation about what is truly important to our community, how do we track it, how do we measure it, and then how do we start making future decisions based on those values.
One of the big future decisions, and maybe not so future given a lot of the other developments that are in progress now, is what we're going to do about housing. I mean, we keep being told by economists that we are well behind the curve and that we are going to need tens of thousands of housing units for everybody from low income all the way up through people who can make luxury choices. And especially for, you know, middle income people who are living and working in Hawaii, trying to raise families, all of that. How do you put housing in the context of all of this when that seems to be the really big one that thwarts a lot of people's happiness?
Funny you should say that. One of the things that we were looking at here in Oregon, so we brought all of our stakeholders together and within government, and we asked for what would be some of the indicators or the pressures on third grade reading. And so we're looking at third grade reading, and third grade reading is a really good indicator of kids graduating high school. Well, we did a regression analysis on all different indicators and data sets. The only one that moved the dial was housing security. It's so hard, you know, you're sitting here thinking about, oh, third grade reading on these things. If you don't have a house, your health care is at issue, education is in peril, all these ripple effects that these holistic integrated indicators that we're talking about really highlight and showcase. What that means for government is that it's not just siloed. It's not just the housing department's responsibility. It's everyone's responsibility. So those are just a couple of tangible things here. I'll let Regina and Kirsten talk about Hawaii.
Looking at Hawaii, for both of my guests in the studio who live here and work here and know what this is all about at a pretty intimate level, that housing question for us has been a longstanding one that we can't seem to be able to answer satisfactorily. How do you put that into the context of a GPI where that's not necessarily part of the larger equation that's been in play for such a long time?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great question. And Kirsten and I did some research. We published a paper about looking at the GPI and how it can be adapted to Hawaii. And just a little bit more about the word holistic. So GPI is a more holistic measure. It looks at economic, environmental, and social factors. It's a set of 27 indicators. And it's been around since 1997. So it's had a good history. And those indicators have been chosen so that they're not double counting and, you know, for other reasons. But curiously enough, the traditional set of indicators for the GPI, the conventional GPI, does not include homelessness, doesn't include the housing situation. And that's one that we flagged as we went through and calculated GPI for Hawaii. There are many things that came up that, okay, well, this is helping us to realize that, okay, so we need to incorporate this issue into our holistic measure because it really does make a difference.
Were you at all surprised that housing hadn't been included in that? It's something that we see as being such a basic fundamental need from most psychological studies.
Definitely.
Of what people need to have, Maslow on down. You've got to have,
yep,
someplace over your head.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting that it is incorporating the cost of living does get incorporated under the economic portion of it. But under the social aspect of it, where I would think housing could be, it's more focused on crime and congestion and education and other, you know, social well-being indicators. But you're right. It's definitely missing. And I think that's how many of the other people who are doing GPI at the state level will be incorporating it and already incorporating housing.
From what Sean just said in the example about the third grade reading, that's clearly tied back to housing. All those other indicators of well-being that go into it, going right back to housing.
Definitely.
So Kirsten, as we know that we're going to continue to grapple with this, how do you envision trying to change the viewpoint in looking at GPI, including housing in Hawaii, when we have finite land, a lot of pressure on very valuable land and what people can do with it and how they can make money off of it?
If I could answer that question, I would probably get tenure instantaneously. I mean, that's really the difficult question that we're facing everywhere in the islands right now. You know, it comes down to starting to have to really talk seriously about our values and what we're willing to trade off. But, you know, in terms of the kind of more technical indicators that we can use, I do think that some of these holistic methods can start to get at the pressures for urbanization, and they're good ways to go about this, right? They're good ways to start to develop communities around urban cores and things like that. So perhaps we need to sit down with some of the planners and really think about how we can create an indicator specifically for housing that would encompass everything from homelessness through the affordability aspects and kind of that urban vibrancy as opposed to the sprawling growth that many states have tried to avoid. Again, Maryland is a great case. I grew up in Northern Virginia that didn't have smart growth policies. Right across the river, Maryland, that did have smart growth policies. And fast forward 30 years, and the difference is enormous in terms of quality of life.
Specifically what?
Congestion, the lack of open space, green spaces, things like this. I would argue environmental quality, air pollution, and things like that as well. But Sean's probably the one to answer that question even more.
Many years. Actually, I'd like to go back to what you were just talking about. When Oregon did RGPI, we did it hand-in-hand with Washington, and this was one of the deficits that we wanted to approach. So we did create a housing security indicator that, again, as you've been kind of hearing, each state has to adapt a little bit, and we need to be moving forward. And I just absolutely love the work that Kirsten and Regina and Hawaii are doing. They added underwater, if I remember correctly, an underwater indicator, and we're trying to deal with housing. And so the one we did here, the best we could do would be the cost of homelessness and the cost of foster care. Now, that doesn't get into the second generation about security and these things that Regina and Kirsten were just talking about, but it was a good first step, and it was much easier for budget and fiscal folks to at least grapple with, and we at least gave us a number to compare with potential economic benefits. And yet, if you don't have enough housing for that, all of a sudden that becomes at best a wash and at worst an economic weight that slows your growth.
Kirsten was talking about the difference between Maryland and Virginia that she saw growing up. A lot of people who have been in Hawaii over the last 30 years watched the urban sprawl start to contract, and especially in very recent years, contract back into the urban corridor in Honolulu. Lots of concern that maybe our infrastructure can't hold that, or we need a whole lot more help to make it so. How do we begin to look at those questions in terms of the GPI and other indicators when deciding to continue to do that, if you're really talking about then creating a great deal more congestion in the urban center?
Yeah, there's definitely a couple different ways that you can approach that issue through GPI, and specifically through the environmental issues, the environmental indicators. There are environmental indicators for wetlands, for farmlands, for forests, and we're proposing to add an additional indicator for coral reefs, nearshore coastal ecosystems. And the way that gets at the development issue, because if we're looking at, you know, total number of hectares of farmland, for example, and the GPI tracks over time what those trends are and then attaches a monetary value per acre, per hectare of the agricultural land, so that if it's lost to development, then that implies that there's a cost, that there's a cost for that loss. Same thing with wetlands, same thing with forests. That if you're impinging upon forests and you're losing acres of forest, what's the monetary value of the acres that are lost? Now, of course, what we're grappling with in our academic point of view is, okay, so if you're losing forests, you're losing forests is one thing, but if those are native forests that are filled with ohia trees, then that might mean another thing. So how does that change the price that is attached to the losses that are occurred? So from the GPI perspective, that's definitely one way you can look at the cost of development, is looking at the losses of the natural environment that we're experiencing because of this loss of development.
And then perhaps coupling with loss of environment, for example, you mentioned ohia trees. With ohia wilt, something that is trying to be contained now, but that changes that equation, I would think, a little bit when you're talking about something that is not in a vacuum that's really feeling the impact of some unfortunate and deleterious effects.
Exactly. When I mentioned invasive species before, invasive species is so unique to Hawaii, you know, the invasive species capital of the U.S. It's so indicative of how we do economic growth. That's, you know, it's because of trade that we are dealing mostly with the invasive species issues, because the things that we bring in from the mainland, from where we bring other places, from other countries, and it's because of we're aspiring for economic growth and bringing these products in, and you know, it's a byproduct of economic growth, really, and it's impacting our unique ecosystems and species that we have here.
Probably too late for what's been happening with Ho'opili and other developments that are looking to go into farmlands, prime ag land that has been a bone of contention for years and years. And you know, your point is, once it's gone, it's gone. Or how are you going to be able to replace it? That replacement cost, have you looked at that in terms of loss of actual areas like Alun Farms to, you know, what looks like it's going to be Ho'opili, and other places that we've been talking about for quite a while in Hawaii, and how that fits into how we create some balance or something that would be giving that GPI trade-off?
That's a really great question. And at this point, those particular values for Hawaii, we have not done yet. No. So when we're taking the GPI, we take data that are publicly available in terms of the acres that are available, the acres that are remaining. We track that over time. And we use that monetary value that I mentioned per acre comes from the literature. So a lot of times, if the information is not available for the Hawaii case, we have to borrow from other studies that have been done or from other states, the numbers that they've used to put a value on an acre. And as we know, in Hawaii, we have such specific and unique situations here that we do need to find a unique value to put on that per acre. And that's something that Kirsten and I could probably work on for the rest of our careers to come up with those numbers. But that's really what we would, that's our ideal that we're pushing for, that we would find those kinds of numbers that we can inform the process even better.
For our listeners just joining us, I just want to remind you that you are listening to Town Square. Tonight we're talking about life beyond GDP. What does that mean? The suggestions are another set of letters, GPI, Genuine Process Indicator. Is that right?
Genuine Progress Indicator.
Sorry. Yeah.
So much easier to say GPI, isn't
it? I know, and I get wrapped up in some of that. I'm sure we all do. The point being is that when you look at a life that's not necessarily tied to your wallet, sounds good. We have a lot of things here to make us happy, to make us feel that we are living truly in paradise, but we know there's costs associated with that. When looking at making trade-offs for those costs and staying here, what is it that can be traded off? What is it that should be traded off? How does that look as we're looking at smart growth and trying to create a paradise as we would like to see it, not necessarily one that's sort of based in mythology, as some people who have grown up here believe that the mythological Hawaii is, you know, something that keeps haunting us. The reality of it, though, is that we have new ways of measuring some of this. Kirsten Olson, Assistant Professor of Ecological Economics with UHM's Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Management, has been working along with Regina Ostergaard-Klem, Associate Professor of Environmental Science in the College of Natural and Computational Sciences at HPU. And all of this kind of got kickstarted a little bit by Sean McGuire, who we talked to 2 months ago when he was here in Hawaii speaking at the Hawaii Economic Association's meeting. And he is the sustainability coordinator for Benton County, Oregon. In trying to make sense of all this picture, I mean, it sounds really good as we talk about it. The problem is trying to put this into some practice and know that the people that you're presenting all this data to are really going to be listening. Sean, how difficult is that when, you know, you get people who nod around the table at you, and yet you look at the policies and think maybe there are going to be some real disconnects here? Do you see that when you look at Hawaii?
I pretty much see that in every government, as we've been talking about earlier. I mean, these are tough decisions. As we reach our limits of growth, we're having to not only decide on these things, but how do we decide? For me, and the things that I've been talking about for a few years is, you know, we just don't have the numbers for the things that matter most. If I asked you what the price of gasoline was, I think the three of you would be probably within a dime of each other. If you ask how much a cup of coffee is, these things you immediately know just by being alive. But if I were to ask you the value of your grandkids' smile, or walking with your parents, or a sunset. You know, we don't have these, but I think that we're, as we've been talking about earlier, we've either identified those as free or as invaluable, but they're not. They're on a ledger somewhere. They just have a zero next to them. And so as each community, whatever that is, a city, a county, a state, country, we're trying to reconcile with that and grapple with how do we measure those things, how do we go about identifying what matters most, and then measuring that. So, I think that's across the board.
It sounds like you're trying to affix a price to things which are in many ways seen as priceless. There were commercials about that for a number of years. Yeah. And, you know, we kind of get that point. But you're really challenging us to try to affix some sort of number to that. How do we begin to do that? Regina, you want to take that?
Sure. And this is an ongoing debate, even from an academic point of view. In 1997, there was a report that came out that sought to put a price tag on all of the natural resources globally as, you know, $33 trillion. You know, how do you come up with that number? But the point was that should you come up with a number like that? And that's really, you know, it received a lot of criticism and, you know, how dare you put a price on natural resources? But they are priceless. Ecosystem services, which are the services that our environment provides for us for filtering our drinking water, for cleaning our air, for capturing the CO2, all these different things that make life possible for us that we don't really put a value on and we don't really even think about, they're priceless. But invariably, I would argue that decision makers, when they have a budget and they need to allocate their budget to certain things, inherently they are putting a price on the environment. Because if the environment doesn't have a price on it and they don't throw money at that, right there, that's been an inherent value that's put on it.
And we've seen things happen for many years with DLNR not having enough resources and a lot made of that. At the same time, there's only so much money in a budget. What you're talking about is more of a broad-based understanding of what it is that we regard as priceless and know that, in fact, if we had to have something that was creating a great amount of filtered water or to be able to take out the CO2, whatever it might be, that would have a price tag.
Exactly. And by putting a monetary value on that, by putting a dollar value on it, it puts it back into the equation. It puts it into the equation if it had been missing before. And without that, people will make, policymakers might make different decisions that aren't thinking about consequences that might happen in the long run, consequences that might damage the ecosystem services that are actually helping us. So it could be counterproductive by not having that in the equation.
Sean, as you sort of pull back a little bit and look at what's happening nationally, do you see that any of this is coming into any of the presidential campaigns and what we talk about on a national level?
Unfortunately, I think recent events have obviously and justifiably taken a front seat. But the fact that we're even talking about this, I keep coming back to this, this was just not even on anyone's radar. I love how Regina just talked about the Costanza reports, like, oh, whatever, it's just a number. But as we reach limits, those numbers matter. You know, we're kind of talking in somewhat in an academic realm, but we do these things every single day. If you have the opportunity to buy a car and all you want is price, well, then we'd all be driving around Ford Pintos and old Toyotas or pickup trucks for $100. But we don't. We start thinking about, if we have a child, how safe is this car? What color is it? But that's not on the itemized deduction or the cost on the side of the car. We put those values internally in our brain when we buy anything, whether that's a cup of coffee or car or house or whatever. We as government can't just do that. We can't just say, hey, everyone trust us. We want it this way. We have to make the case. And that's why when these things called valuation, which is kind of what we're talking about, putting a value on non-market or non-use goods and services, exactly as Regina just said, it puts it on the ledger so that we appreciate it. And there's no greater topic than climate change and carbon in the air. And that is a concern because that has been, as we've been saying, for free. When you buy anything, carbon is not included in that cost. If it were, all of a sudden, renewable energy would be the cheapest option. But since carbon pollution is free, then it's not. And so that is, I think, on the front lines of the presidential debate as well as being talked about nationally.
As we are talking tonight, the Paris Climate Summit is now in its second week, and with a draft that seems to be pretty good, at least Senator Brian Schatz likes it. Others are saying, well, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out when it's a voluntary effort, even though you have a lot of the big polluters, China included, involved with all of it. How do you begin to make the case in the international climate that it's not just a matter of what happens with global warming, but some of these values that are so disparate from one country to another in making a better sense of, I don't know how to frame it in terms of, because you can't have everybody have the same values.
No, I'm part of the work that has been going into the buildup of the climate conference is trying to put a social cost on a ton of emitted carbon. And this is the idea that obviously we all nations are emitting carbon, and that carbon is causing damages or will cause damages in the future. And those damages are distributed around the world unevenly. But every ton, we know that it's going to cause damage. And so the social cost of carbon is the idea of putting a price on each ton of carbon or greenhouse gas that's being emitted and making the emitter responsible for it. So they would, it's a mechanism to internalize the externality in economic jargon. So to take those impacts that you know are happening and put them back into the calculus of the business that is generating those greenhouse gases.
You have to hope, though, that the country that is internalizing those externalities is going to give more than just lip service to actually doing something about it.
Well, it totally changes the incentive system, right? So if you're responsible for paying the social cost of the carbon emissions that you're making, you're not going to burn coal, for instance, right? Because it's going to be very expensive. Coal's going to be more expensive than wind or another renewable energy, right? And it goes for all sorts of economic activities, for agriculture, your agricultural practices. It will completely change the marketplace for consumers. So consumers will start making different decisions. We'll eat less meat because it will be more expensive because you'll have to pay for the carbon emissions of the animals, et cetera.
That is going to be, in many ways, it seems difficult to be able to police or enforce, and it may be based on how good the data is and how much that's actually reported appropriately, and then who is going to be some arbiter of who gets to be assessed and who doesn't and how much.
Well, and this goes again to the different mechanisms that they're talking about putting a carbon tax on, right? Ultimately, a carbon tax is a type of fee for each ton of carbon emitted. And then the presumption is that the producer of a good would pass that on to the consumer. So it's ultimately the nations that have to put it in place. Although in the United States, there's been discussion about it being at the state level. But
have there been discussions about that in Hawaii that you know of?
No, not that I know of.
Not that I know of either. Mm-hmm.
But the mere fact that, we have so many nations, 200 nations that have come together to look at this might, in fact, be reinforcing what the three of you have been talking about, that in some ways there are mechanisms for finding shared values and getting various nations to buy into those. How well it actually happens in practice is not something that, we've seen yet because this is very, very new. But at least you must be heartened that in some ways, this begins to validate a lot of the work that you've been doing.
It does. It definitely does. I mean, maybe I'm purely Pollyanna-ish. Is that a word? Being Pollyanna here. But I think that this particular COP21 in Paris is an indicator that people are definitely getting it. And they're recognizing that there are costs involved with climate change. And in fact, there's reports that for China, for example, the extreme environmental damages and the air pollution and all those things are costing the GDP of China, several percentage points. So it's, you can, once that the nations start tying it back to seeing real damages and real costs, I think that provides unfortunately, that provides the incentive. Maybe too late, but you know, it could have been much earlier. But it's providing an incentive for everybody to say, okay, we really do need to do something about this now.
Sean, is that sort of the defining line when we begin to approach, you know, a critical point that it unfortunately is the place where we need to be before heads turn?
Unfortunately, you got to wait until there's only 9 California condors, and then, oh, hey, wait, we might want to save those. Maybe scarcity lights a fire. It is unfortunate. It is. I would like to get back to not only the Pollyanna-ish, which I love, as well as Kirsten's comment about the ripple effect and about how the economic decisions we make each and every day, you know, the economy itself is a system. It's not good or bad. It's just working under the rules. But if we change these rules, we might get positive outcomes from it without having to do too much other than upfront. So if we do fix some sort of carbon tax, some sort of carbon cost, then all of a sudden perhaps renewable energy becomes a cheaper option, which we know creates more jobs than non-renewable options. Okay, so that increases jobs, that decreases unemployment, starts to offset some of the costs that we have, and also not cleans our air, but at least abates our pollution. That's kind of the things we're talking about. Let's start using the system in a more regenerative way than in a more destructive way, which we've done for the past 200 years.
We are talking about scarcity in all of that. For Hawaii, being an island nation, it's not so much scarcity as just, you know, finite amount of everything that we have. And it seems that there is something that's almost, you know, missing in this conversation about that. In the general conversation, we talk about, you know, food security. We talk about how much we have to bring in. We talk and talk and talk a lot about that, but we don't necessarily affix prices to that in the absence of all of those things in having to bring them to us if we are, in fact, taking away other resources that might help that equation somewhat to at least, you know, bump it up a little bit. Will we be able to feed ourselves 100%? Probably not. Kirsten and Regina, as you've been working on this, and seeing that obviously there's so much attention being placed on food security lately, has that been factored in at a greater level than, say, in other states?
So, again, one thing that I do want to say is that Hawaii has a very unique position when we're talking about the climate change issues because, as we always talk about, we're candidates not just for the damages that we're causing by importing all of our things and the fossil fuels that are needed to bring everything to us out here in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, but we're also uniquely positioned to be, you're going to have damages suffered as well. So it's not even just the damages that we're causing to others because of our CO2 emissions related to how we live here, but because we're an island, we're going to be suffering from the damages that others have caused as well. So when we get talking about the food security issues, that's one other thing that we flagged in this, you know, going back all the way now to the GPI, you know, how do we incorporate the idea of food security into the GPI as an indicator? And the way that we would do it through GPI is looking exactly at the non-renewable resources and the fuel that you would need to not just grow the food here, but to bring all that food in and plus all the other goods that we need to live here. So that's one of the indicators that takes on, you know, tracking CO2 and looking at the emissions that are associated with how we choose to live our lives here.
Yeah, I mean, food security is an interesting topic here in the islands because we can get such cheap food from elsewhere and ship it in mm-hmm. to ourselves, right? And that's facilitated by the fact that fuel is so cheap that we don't pay for our carbon emissions. That we don't pay for any of the environmental damages in the places where that are growing the food, that we don't pay fair wages to farm workers in those places, right? So all of that is facilitated, and it makes the economic calculus so biased in terms of whether we should be growing food here. It doesn't make rational sense given the current structure of the world food economy to grow food on land that is orders of magnitude more valuable for housing. And that's really the difficulty here. So the discussion is one of a conflict of values where we feel like we want to be more secure. We want to reduce the risk of having something happen and us not being able to feed ourselves. We value the rural lifestyle and the rural aesthetics of the landscapes. But none of those things have prices attached to them. So we continue to buy the $1.50 butter that comes from a dairy that grows their cattle in a confined animal feeding operation, right?
We talked with a young farmer not too long ago about changes he saw coming down the pike in Hawaii in farming. And one of his comments was that this is all about really reprioritizing our lives and our lifestyles. How do you begin to make that case to the average person that what you're talking about isn't something that they, you know, should resent, but just to keep an open mind and try to see how it might, in fact, make their lives better?
Yeah, that goes back to the whole sustainability hysteria type of idea that, you know, if we're going to live sustainably, then, you know, are we going to end up living like cavemen, you know, type of thing? Are we going back to, you know, pre-industrial revolution types of things? So, no, that's not a possibility. I think that there's a couple different things we have to look at. First of all, personal consumption and what our patterns are of personal consumption and how we choose to practice and to practice what we preach. But also I think we need to look at businesses, the involvement of businesses. So we've been talking about policymakers earlier, and now we're talking about personal consumption, but we also have to think about how do businesses incorporate putting the right price on some of these damaging environmental practices that we have. So it's not just the consumers making better informed decisions about what they consume and how they choose to purchase things, but it's businesses in terms of how they produce things, how they market things. And I think many businesses now are starting to realize that we have to incorporate the prices, the true cost of many of their goods and services. And at the same time, they might even be able to save money. You know, make it available to the businesses so that if they are cutting back on waste that's harming the environment, it might also be helping their manufacturing processes or their growing processes and would be a win-win for both the business and the environment.
It sounds like that you're not including any of the big box retailers that we see in that, because by their very nature, they're bringing things in here at a much lower price point. Mm-hmm. How do you get people to not say, gee, that's a good thing?
It's very, very difficult. You have to make it, first of all, easy for people, because people won't change behavior unless it's actually reasonable and something that's not drastic. The public can provide pressure on policymakers. The public can provide pressure on the big box suppliers. And even if you look at big box suppliers, look at their supply chain. Look at where they're buying their products from to sell to us. A big box supplier could have the potential of, if they were forced to really green their supply chain, they could make tremendous change throughout the entire supply chain itself.
Very briefly, if you're talking about a big box retailer that starts with the letter C, how would you expect that they might do that? I mean, they're buying some things locally. I mean, you can just fill in the blank with anyone.
Right.
But how do you do that?
As the public, you take the power that you have to vocalize and vote with what you're really going to buy.
And I think we're seeing that, not just in Hawaii, but across the country, the rise of co-ops, farmers markets. I'm willing to pay a little bit more for my vegetables that I know that I actually meet the farmer. And we're seeing that across the board. I don't want to say the globalization is necessarily wrong. It's not the panacea that everyone thinks it is. And this is how we're seeing in local communities, big boxes are being thrown to the side so that we can really reinvest in ourselves and our own communities.
We have just a couple more minutes before we have to say goodbye. And I'm curious, because we've talked a lot about this, how would you prescribe some basic bottom line change here that might be a good first step to get people to understand that this isn't scary necessarily, but it could be, you know, quite appropriate and also even fun?
I will marry academia and what's happening in the next couple of weeks, and that's the holidays. Study after study shows that people get a better response. They're a little bit happier, have a little better sense of well-being when they purchase an experience as opposed to a product. The experience lasts a lifetime, whereas buying another thing that may be in a closet or thrown away before New Year's Eve is not as much. It's just starting with recognizing that in and of itself is, number one, a decision, and two, a decision based on a value, and that is of community, of togetherness, like what makes us truly happy.
Is that something, though, an awareness that comes with maturity? Because we've seen this kind of happen over time that, for example, as women age, there are some studies that show that they start buying less stuff and more experiences. That isn't necessarily going to wash with somebody who may be, you know, 25 and looking to totally bling out. and really doesn't care as long as, you know, the bling is there.
I think that that's being challenged right now. We're hearing more and more millennials. I live in a college town. I'm stunned. Most of these kids don't even have a driver's license yet, and they're in college. They haven't bought a car. It's been very fascinating. Again, it's not across the board, but I think that might be changing. I'm interested to see what happens in the next 5 or 10 years as millennials get older. But already that might be changing, whether you want to pin that on digital and Facebook and phones and all these kinds of things. That might be one aspect. But, again, we might just culturally be in a shift.
Well, we'll see what happens as we have millennials who are now in the upper echelon of that generation. I'm going to ask Regina and Kirsten for a couple of thoughts about Hawaii. And having talked about all the things that we've talked about tonight, and there's a lot of feel good in it. There's a lot of good reason to be part of it. How logical do you feel that this is an argument that is going to resound well in the ears of lawmakers?
What's happening on the ground is really positive. I mentioned before that we work with Hawaii Green Growth. Hawaii Green Growth Initiative is creating a dashboard of indicators that's available to the public. It's available to decision makers and policymakers that tracks different aspects of our environment here, different aspects of the society. It's still in its planning stages, but they're out there working hard trying to get that information out there. So I'm encouraged by the connections that they're making between policymakers and the general public and NGOs and the community. And, you know, everybody has to play a role within these things. And I'm encouraged to see that there is so much movement and education, including the young people. There's many things that are out there. And I think the time has come. And again, maybe being Pollyannish, I don't know, I'm thinking that this movement is going to continue into the future because it needs to. It's going to come to a point where we don't have much of a choice.
Kirsten?
So in the genuine progress indicator, we look for this inflection point where we see economic growth on an upward trajectory and the genuine progress indicator rises and then suddenly doesn't rise as fast as GDP. And I think that that's a good metaphor for personal life as well, where you can think about your income and you can continue to, or your things, the things you have around you, and those may continue to accumulate and grow. But is your progress continuing to grow at a similar rate, or do you feel like there are other things that you could be doing in order to increase your happiness as you move forward? Sean nailed it, the idea of not looking to things to make you happy, but looking to experiences, connecting with your heritage, your culture, your family. Those are the things that ultimately make us happy. And getting kids outside early and often so that they connect with nature. There are so many studies out there that talk about how important that is for all sorts of happiness indicators and attainment goals. And it's less of a concern, I suppose, for some people in Hawaii, but really getting that connection to the environment so we don't have this shifting baseline problem where the kids are like, oh, it's always been concrete. It's okay.
Well, I wish you lots of the simple things this holiday season and always. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us. And Sean, a pleasure to have you back.
It was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you all for joining us tonight for a special recorded Town Square as we are now closing out the last hour for tonight of the Radio Flyers campaign. Thank you so much for all the calls and the pledges. And thanks to our guest tonight, Kirsten Olson, the Assistant Professor of Ecological Economics with UHM's Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Management, and Regina Ostergaard-Klemm, Associate Professor of Environmental Science in the College of Natural and Computational Sciences at Hawaii Pacific University. And by phone, Sean McGuire, the Sustainability Coordinator for Benton County, Oregon. We'll see you next week, right back here for Town Square, and I'll see you tomorrow morning on The Conversation. Take good care. Aloha.